there. This is Creative Block. My name is Kyle Marshall. I'm the owner of Media Lab YYC, which is located in Calgary, Alberta. And man, I haven't done enough with my life. Today, I have the pleasure of talking with Ben Burney. I met Ben via the internet years ago after he swindled me out of my entire life savings, but he made a good case for that Nigerian prince. Actually, we met because we were part of a startup that eventually imploded, but even with that experience, I've always been impressed by Ben's tenacity, curiosity, and talent. Throughout his life, he has been a Broadway composer, a lawyer, and an author. It's that last one that we're going to talk about primarily here today. Ben's first novel, The Bright Path, was just released, and you could pick it up right now. I've left a link in the description to this episode. What's also cool is that Ben has made a podcast for his book where each week he reads you another chapter. I think it's an inspired way to market your writing. But before we get to the conversation, I have a couple of sponsors this week. First and foremost, I should mention that Creative Block is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. The Alberta Podcast Network promotes and supports Alberta-made podcasts and connects their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. You can find all the great shows at albertapodcastnetwork.com. Our first sponsor is Back to School Again. This is a podcast hosted by Katrina Ingram, presented by Norquest College. She interviews people who have returned to the classroom in midlife and chronicles her own journey as an adult who finds herself back in school. And if she can't convince her parents to get together, she'll never be born. Wait, no, that's something else. You'll also learn about the unique programs at Norquest College that help it provide learning opportunities for all. It comes out every 2 weeks, and you can read the show notes and subscribe at backtoschoolagain.ca. Our second sponsor is ATB. If you're starting to build a business, ATB's Entrepreneur Center is a great resource. They can help you with banking and set you up with a mentor. There are also opportunities for networking and workshops to help make local connections within the community. I've also heard they're a great resource to steal the dragon's gold. You just have to look for the missing scale. Anyway, the Entrepreneur Center is just another way ATB will always be more than a bank. Visit our locations in Edmonton, Calgary, and Lethbridge. Find out more information at atbentrepreneurcenter.com. Thank you to our sponsors, and now let's get into my conversation with Ben. It goes to a bunch of different topics, but I was fascinated the entire time. Also, in this conversation, you will hear about video game music, law school, and fantasy novels. Let's go to that now. Ben Burney, thank you so much for joining me.
I am so happy to be here, Kyle. In fact, it has been my ambition for quite some time now to be interviewed by Kyle Marshall on Creative Block.
No joke. Well, thank you so much. I guess you can't see it, but I'm blushing. Just in case people are unaware, maybe you could introduce yourself and tell a little bit about what it is that you do.
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to do that. I do quite a few things, but I think as relates to the audience that's listening today, I write words, and I write music, and sometimes I write poetry, and sometimes I even manage to get those things in front of other people to listen to.
Well, it's nice. That's good. I mean, I forget who I read it from, but basically you can't consider yourself like an author or an artist if you're never actually showing the stuff that you're producing to other people. At a certain point, you have to kind of give those babies away and be judged or not judged based on your merits.
Well, as I'm sure anybody who does that would tell you, that's the hardest part. I've wrestled with that a little bit with the book that I've been doing lately, Kyle. And the reason I've wrestled with it is that ages ago, like 10 years ago, back when the dinosaurs were hunting cavemen.
Before the first iPhone, yeah.
I produced my own musicals in New York. And I remember, you know, spending a lot of money and organizing many different people to act as a producer to get these things on stage. And it was really a team effort for those musicals. And I loved it. I mean, it was incredible to see so many people working together to bring it together. But then when I started the book, I thought, you know, I could just write this book and never give it to anybody. And it would still be a book. I mean, I would still think of it as a complete novel that existed. It doesn't, from a certain perspective, it doesn't actually need anybody else to read it. But then from another perspective, what I found as I was getting into the editing process was, actually, you do need the other people because you won't make it as good as it can be if it's just you. If it's just going to be me picking it up 10 years from now and reading it, like I could stop at some point. But knowing that I actually would like people to read it and to react to it and to, I hope, be moved by it. I mean, that really has been a big motivation for me to make it good. So where I'm going with this, and I'm not just like trying to shamelessly plug my book here, although I am, but where I'm going with this is that actually books do need an audience too, that it's not just a thing that happens in a void, as easy as it is to think that when you're sitting alone writing.
Yeah, it's something that I struggle with a whole lot. I mean, I'm fairly productive with the output that I make, whether it's videos or podcasts, and I fashion myself a writer someday. I do want to publish that book that I wrote a few years ago eventually, but I wonder if I could ever just be fine with publishing it and walking away. Like, there's this idea that I do want to have a large-ish reach. Not that I necessarily want to be famous. That has never really been the driver for me. It's been more like, well, I would like there to be at least a few people in the world that are like, yes, I enjoy what you do. And yeah. I don't know if that's necessarily narcissistic of me or how I want to take that for myself.
I don't think that's narcissism, Kyle. I think that's the standard issue creative impulse. Mm-hmm. We do it to share it with people. This vision of the artist as a solitary genius, I think, is way off. I can't think of any that really, I mean, maybe it's just my lack of education, but I can't think of any artist that just sat alone in his room and created art and then everybody thought it was great.
Yeah, I mean, it's also this other thing that I'm very slowly pulling away from. It was this idea, thing that's been handed down for decades or probably even like centuries now at this point, where there's this idea of the tortured artist, where it's like you have to suffer for years and you have to like eat breadcrumbs and you have to cut off your own ear.
Yeah, we both went there. We both went right there.
I know. But it's that you have to do that. And I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think that art, no matter how good you are, is something that takes time and it takes patience and it does take other people. No one becomes who they are in a silo. You might work by yourself, but to actually improve and grow, I think, requires that outside observance.
It does, but then it also requires some kind of god-awful thing inside you to push it out. There are plenty of people out there who write and try to push it out in front of a large audience and just don't have that spark. That doesn't mean they're bad people or they're, you know, worthless or anything like that, but there is a sense of urgency and internal motivation, I think, to people who are really making good, I don't even want to call it art because that's way too pretentious, but but good storytelling through media.
Yeah.
That's way too vague.
No, that's, I tend to agree. However, we started this very general. Let's get it specifically.
Yeah, sorry about that, Kyle.
No, I love it. It's that idea of storytelling. Who would you consider to be the first great storyteller that came into your life?
The first great storyteller that came into my life. That is kind of a curveball, but I'm going to have to go with Tolkien. And it's a bit of a stock response, I think, from somebody who's writing fantasy, but you just can't get away from Tolkien. He's too big, and he dominates the genre too much. You're either writing like Tolkien or you're consciously not writing like Tolkien. So going back to your question, he was the first great storyteller that I read.
What age would you have been?
6.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Are we talking Hobbit or are we doing Lord of the Rings?
I read The Hobbit and I went right on to Lord of the Rings.
Okay. I read Silmarillion first. Yeah.
That is impressive. I have to say, Kyle,
no,
I tried
I'm
to read
joking.
The Silmarillion and I like dropped dead. It's so boring.
I know. It's like, yeah. It's basically like reading the Bible, except not for an actual religion, and I just can't do it.
Right. Yeah, now the stock answer, I think the stock answer that some people who identify as Christian would give you is that the Bible is the greatest story they'd ever read. And I can remember reading the Bible at a very young age. My dad was a minister, and I don't ever remember thinking, wow, this is some hot... Am I allowed to swear on your podcast?
Yeah, you can go ahead.
Okay. I don't ever remember thinking, wow, this is some hot shit. This is some awesome storytelling that I'm reading here. And there's a lot of stories in the Bible. And some of them are quite colorful, involve people getting their heads cut off and raped and murdered and, you know, eaten by locusts. But I never thought it was a particularly compelling piece of storytelling, to be honest.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. There's going to be lots of people who probably disagree with our point of view on this, but I kind of come in the same way. I feel that Bible stories are better when they are retold, I guess, for lack of a better word, because as written, I find them too parable-like, where it's like, I don't know, it's like this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, instead of it actually pulling me through with an actual storyline.
Right. Well, and they're all morality tales, so either that works for you, or it doesn't.
Sure.
And I think the people for whom that works are easy to identify, and easy for themselves to identify. You know, if you're moved by that, great, that's your thing.
So what was it about Tolkien then, though? Like, can you verbalize what it was that drew you to him?
I think I would have to say it's the breadth of imagination in Tolkien and the vision of storytelling over a long arc. I had never seen anything like that. And I think everything I'd read before that was very modest children's fare. And then somebody handed me The Hobbit. It was this beat up, dusty old copy from like the 1950s. I've still got it. It's held together with tape. And it had a very pedestrian cover. It was not exciting to look at. But when I read that first chapter of The Hobbit, I thought, holy camoli, this is what storytelling's about. I've got these funny characters, but there's clearly something big going on, and it's a whole world I never imagined. Somehow he manages to use language, and not by accident, in a way that grabs, I think, an English speaker by the short and curlies and says, you better pay attention, because I've reached deep down into what makes you an English-speaking person, and I am going to use it to draw you into this story. And I say not by accident, of course, because the man was a linguist, and he studied Old English, and he, you know, he knew exactly what he was doing, and did it brilliantly.
Yeah, I know even for me, like the Hobbit is something that's very special in my own personal library, but I agree, when you start getting into children's fiction, I happen to have I really like a lot of children's lit and young adult lit, even though I think some people look down on it a whole lot. But the Hobbit is very different from from other books that are in that genre, because it feels such like a lived in place right from chapter one, and it doesn't necessarily need to go into all the backstory first. It's like, let's let you just be a part of this world, and we'll layer on other things later.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the other great and brilliant thing about The Hobbit is the way he basically took a 20th century Englishman and plopped him down into this world of dragons and elves and goblins that would otherwise seem pretty alien, but that the character Bilbo and then later the other hobbits are our touch. You know, they're our connection to reality. They are the middle-aged English gentrymen who would just rather like to have some sausages for breakfast.
Sure. But who doesn't, really? When did you start writing yourself?
That's a great question. So the short answer is that writing fiction for other people is very new to me. I started about 2 years ago. But I have to acknowledge that I played some badass Dungeons and Dragons about the age of six, about the same time I started reading The Hobbit, and was often, not always, but often in the role of the Dungeon Master. And in that role, you are constantly writing. You're constantly making up stories to tell to other people. So I would say, really, I started very, very young. And it was, I'm not going to be apologetic about playing Dungeons and Dragons, because it's awesome.
Okay. Well, this is going to be a even broader topic than I thought it was going to be. But first of all, who was playing with you at 6 years old? Dragons specifically.
It was like my next door neighbor, David Holman, who has gone on to also be a brilliant storyteller and a very good author. He's written his own books. So maybe there's a connection there. But he and I started at a super young age. He was actually a few years younger than me. And I'm just guessing six, but maybe he was six and I was eight or something like that.
Sure, sure. Dungeons and Dragons is this really fascinating cultural touch point for me, because I, as with many people, did absolutely look down on it growing up. I thought that was, I'm a nerd, but I'm not that nerdy. I'm not going to go into the Dungeons and Dragons things. And I think part of it, what was that? Gosh, there was a Tom Hanks movie that basically vilified Dungeons and Dragons. And I can't remember what the name of it is now, but I think I saw that and just, that's what I took it as. There was like an entry point to Satanism almost. So there's something that this really put me off about it. However, having gotten into university and kind of sort of played it there a couple of times, but with a really bad dungeon master, I've since learned that's why I didn't take to it. And then playing it in my adulthood with really good people that can tell stories, that was what opened my mind to be like, oh, okay, now I kind of get what this is. This is not just, I don't know, a bunch of dorks like dressed in robes and thinking that they're slaying a dragon. This is actually like improv and storytelling and all this really neat interaction. And I think what really opened my mind was that there's now all of these actual play podcasts which listen in on people playing Dungeons and Dragons. And the best of them are so engaging just as a lover of stories to them. So I can definitely see where storytelling would be really, really critical for your, I don't know, being that dungeon master of Dungeons and Dragons. What was your favorite storyline that you created?
Oh, you know, I did some really good ones in college that I'm very fond of, and in fact have drawn on in the writing that I've done more recently. Not for specifics, but for background and ideas and sort mm-hmm. of character. So I had some fun ones in college. I don't think I could do justice to any of them in 30 seconds on a podcast. But the guys I was playing with in college, Art Munson and Seth Brown and Katie Miyamoto, those were some serious improv comedic storytellers that could pull together a group in a way that I've never seen before or since. And you know, we all helped each other to grow as storytellers just by sitting around the table and having fun.
Mm-hmm. So you're 60 years old playing Dungeons and Dragons, but where were you born and where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in DC, but my family moved up the East Coast of the United States to Maine when I was 4 years old. So I think of myself as somebody from Maine. There is a subset of people from Maine who would say I'm not really from Maine because I haven't been there for four generations. And right. None of those people are my friends.
What does it mean to be from Maine? Like, what is the stereotype?
Well, that's the stereotype. I think that there is a certain stereotype of countrified backwater hicks maybe going out on a lobster boat and smoking marijuana and bringing lobsters back. And then there's another one of potato farmers up north doing the kinds of things that people did in Deliverance. And
right.
Maybe there are some of those people, but to be honest, I've met some very urbane and well-educated lobstermen, and I've never met any potato farmers at all. So I don't know that those are accurate perceptions of Maine. It is, you know, a kind of an economically depressed place. It never recovered from losing a lot of industry, but it's a beautiful place, and I think the people that live there generally have a lot of character.
Yeah, the one time I was actually in Maine, I just recall being like, oh, now I understand why Stephen King writes the way he does, because everything kind of looks like a Stephen King description, especially like early in the morning if there's a fog or something rolling in. It's just like, oh, yeah, I could see some monster kind of coming out of the woods then.
Yeah, there can be a little bit of eeriness to it in the same way that, you know, if you go to upstate New York to, you know, Sleepy Hollow country, you get some of that.
So I know you said that your father was a minister. What did your mother do?
My mother taught horseback riding for quite some time, and so I had the opportunity to grow up on a farm with horses, and in fact, she taught me to ride horses. Mm. I could probably still do it if I found a very, very friendly horse who was willing to be very patient with me, but she was very good at it. She taught dressage riding, which is a kind of riding that you do in shows, and we had some wonderful horses hanging around.
That's cool.
Then one of them kicked her in the head, and I kind of went downhill from there. She recovered completely.
Okay, so like no brain damage or anything like that?
No, she got her hand up just in time, and it broke her arm instead of like smashing her skull in. That horse didn't last that much longer. But most of the horses were very, very friendly and personable.
You had glue for years, though. It was great.
Oh, yeah. We sold him on.
So I guess how would you describe your childhood then? Was it, I don't know, great, bad, mediocre? I don't know. How would you consider your...
I had an outstanding childhood, Kyle, mm-hmm. and I'm not going to lie. I grew up on a farm by a river with lots of open fields and forests and neighbors across the street who would invite my family and I over to help them hay the fields. I could like go out and camp in our fields all summer, which is where I read The Lord of the Rings for the first time, like sitting in a camp in a tent with a flashlight. I learned to swim in the river. I built tree houses in the trees that are still there. I go past that house every now and then, and I still see them. They've stood the test of time. So it was a pretty cool childhood, I've got to say. And I credit my parents for putting us down in a place where we were pretty much guaranteed to have an A+ childhood.
That feels like such an American upbringing in a way. I don't know, like Huckleberry Finn or something like that. That's what it feels like to me. This like
idyllic
kind of childhood where you can just roam and go
out.
Yeah,
they used to kick us out of the house and like say, "All right, see you at supper time. Go play."
Yeah, I don't know how much that actually happens anymore. I'm not sure. How did you like school? Was that something that you enjoyed doing, or is it just something that you had to kind of endure?
You know, for the first 6 years, first through sixth grade, I endured school. It was okay from time to time, but I was a good student, but didn't have a lot of opportunities to show it. In seventh and eighth grade, it got really bad. My middle school was not, I don't know, some people have enjoyed it, but it didn't work for me. And I was punished by my peers for being somebody who wanted to do well and was interested in the subjects and intellectually curious and kind of a dork. So there was a lot of bullying and really unpleasant stuff. But then in ninth grade, my parents made another great decision to pull me out of that school and put me in a different school, which totally turned my life around. That was Wainfleet School in Portland, Maine. And they'll be the first people I give $1 million to when I make $2 million, because that school absolutely saved my life and saved me from being, frankly, a druggie pumping gas after his third felony. So, you know, it is amazing how much difference at that age the right place, the right school can make to somebody who's right on the edge of going the right way or going the wrong way.
Well, what was it about that school that you were just a better fit for?
Well, it was a place where you could just be yourself, and the student body was incredibly welcoming. I mean, I walked in there and instantly had not friends, but people who accepted me for who I was. It was okay to hang out in the computer lab and be a dork and like write computer games and sort of get into trouble that way. It was okay to be good at math. It was okay to like reading in English class. People just were chill about it. And they're like, "Oh yeah, you're cool, man. It's all right." They weren't all like that. I mean, there were some stoners and some jocks, but they were all very, very accepting and warm. And I couldn't wish for a better high school experience for anybody.
Well, you said that they accepted you for who you were. So who were you in high school?
Well, what I discovered about myself in high school was that I had a bit of a sharp edge, and I also enjoyed making things. That was the first time, I think, in high school, I really had the opportunity to make something and to do some serious storytelling. And that was with five friends, the six of us together. They were all a year ahead of me. And we sat down in the computer lab at Wainfleet, and we made a game. It was called Mantra, or Mantra, depending on how you want to pronounce it. And this was like 1993. Mantra was a game for Macs at a time when there were practically no games for Macs, and we released it for free on the newly available interwebs. So there were it was a rather extraordinary experience. Suddenly we had fans. Like we had people who would write to us and say, "Oh my God, I love this game. Make more games." So the six of us spent most of our high school career teaching ourselves C++ and Mac assembly and figuring out how to make sprites move on screen. I did most of the music for those games, and people still sometimes contact me and tell me how much they like that music. So it was pretty cool. I discovered that I was somebody who loved creating, mm-hmm. and I did not have the opportunity to do that until I got to that place at Wainfleet and met, frankly, five of the smartest dudes I've ever met in my life. These guys had taught themselves C++. Which is not an easy language.
No.
They just opened the books and kind of figured it out. And good C++. These guys were teaching themselves object-oriented, like good architecture in ninth grade.
That blows my mind, because the very little coding I've ever done is like I can get up to basically writing a couple of lines, and it's like, all right, I don't know what I have to do from here, especially when you get into like functions and like it's over my head. It feels like word math for me. I feel like that is such a unique experience to be in high school and developing a game that people legitimately find that they want to play like that. And I think that's like right place, right time, because it's getting even more and more complicated, I think, to break in to the video game industry, at least at a high level. You definitely can do some very basic designs and stuff like that. What was the basic storyline of that game?
You know, honestly, it was kind of a clone of The Legend of Zelda. You walked around with a sword, and as one of the programmers memorably phrased it, you just poke them till they pop. And that was the cut. But you know, there were lots of good maps. There were different terrain types. There was like desert and woods and towns. And we spent a lot of time with making people and making little dialogue boxes for them to talk through. in many respects, it was kind of somewhere between Zelda and Final Fantasy.
Gotcha. So as far as the music goes, is this the first time you were composing music was for this game, or had that come before?
No, this was the first time. And I had this program called, I'm blanking on it. It was a program that made what they called mods, which were you took a bunch of pre-sampled instruments and you kind of arranged them on a grid. You weren't writing music notation in the traditional sense, but you were creating these mod tracks that you would put together. And then they would, you know, you'd put together a 1 or 2 minute loop and it would play. And today they sound very kind of dated. But on the other hand, people still like them. Like, people still listen to them, and not just for nostalgia. One guy sent us a remix of those tracks that he'd done.
Oh, that's cool.
Like 2 years ago, which
oh,
was
wow. Okay.
About as awesome an experience as I'd had up to that point.
Because that's, would that be... would be considered MIDI music, or was there more like, I don't know, orchestral nature to it?
No, it was even simpler than MIDI. Like, it didn't even use MIDI signals in the way that we mean that term when we talk about it. They were just arrangements of pitched tones on a grid, and you had a variety of pitched tones you could use, but that was basically it. Like, you had 4/4 time and a grid, and you put them on the grid, and that was the order they played in.
You know, it's interesting, though, like, I grew up at a time where, like, Nintendo and Sega were battling it out for supremacy for the console market. And there was definitely computer games as well, but I was much more of a console gamer growing up as a kid and teenager. And those early games, especially on, like, the 8-bit and 16-bit systems, while absolutely crude and not an actual full instrument, like, they were really dumbing it down, like, with those MIDI controls. When they are transposed, I've had the opportunity to go to at least Calgary's Philharmonic Orchestra here. Well, every year usually does like a video game night where they take video game music but put it into the orchestra. And I feel like the people who are composing at that time, the composers of those early video games, sometimes don't get as much recognition as I think that they should, because they basically took this orchestral score and then made it fit for a video game. That sounds great. And it's too bad you couldn't hear that full nature back then, but you could kind of imagine it when you were a kid playing it.
Well, I mean, some of those guys, the one that I would point to is Nobuo Uematsu, who did the Final Fantasy games, and of course now is a colossal superstar. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he wrote those themes for Final Fantasy I, the original Nintendo Entertainment System, Final Fantasy I, and it was brilliant. At the time, that music was brilliant. I still hear it in its original form and think, this is good music. I enjoy listening to this. And I feel like I have pretty good taste in music, but he was onto something. He knew how to write a tune, that guy. And the fact that it's now been taken and expanded into these orchestral treatments just speaks to the underlying strength and vision of the musical storyteller. And he is a musical storyteller, just like an opera writer is.
What did you go to university for initially?
I studied computer science in university, mainly on the strength of enthusiasm from all that programming in high school. I thought, oh, I want to do more of this. I want to write video games. So I went to college and got into the computer science program and found that actually the computer science department was a bunch of frustrated math professors who somehow had gotten into computers. It was very theoretical. It was very dry, very abstract, and there was really nothing fun about it, unless you were into math, and I was never into math. So it was not a great fit academically, but it did give me a great foundation that has been an absolute bedrock of my career since then. So I can't say I'm not grateful to those very dry math professors. They were great guys, but at the time, I did not appreciate it.
Oh, for sure. So did you eventually got a degree in computer science?
I did, and I also got a dual major in music as well. I discovered the music department and actually had some of the same arguments with them about how they did music that I did with the computer science people. I thought it was very dry, very academic, and not very attractive, which is a legitimate criticism of modern academic music. But nonetheless, they did give me a great theoretical foundation on which to continue creating music for the rest of my life. So again, my hat's off to those guys. Even though I didn't like it at the time and I thought they were a bunch of dopes, they did give me a gift that I have never lost.
What was your plan then after graduation? Was there something you had lined up already, or what did you think you were going to go out and do after you were done college?
Yeah, so my vision coming out of college was music theater. I had taken a music theater class in college from a guy called Greg Pliska, who's gone on to great things. And in that class, I started collaborating with the man who would be my writing partner for some years, Rob Seidelman. And Rob and I did this 10-minute musical treatment of Paradise Lost. And yes, that's John Milton's Paradise Lost, the 12-book epic poem in iambic pentameter. So we took the character of Satan and did this 10-minute musical treatment of Satan. And we loved it. And other people loved it, too. It was really, really fun. And I thought there were some really good musical themes that came out of that. So my vision was, I want to get into music theater composing. I want to write musicals. But I knew that it was going to take years to do that. And, you know, during those years, I would have to eat. So I took that computer science degree and started a small business writing mainly content management systems for small businesses who needed that sort of thing back in the early aughts.
Right.
I got hooked up with some ad agencies who fed me work, which was great, and was able to float along for a couple of years until I got picked up by a larger company, Tilson Technology, which brought me in to start their software development group.
This is really fascinating. I think you've had a really interesting life because there's so many different avenues.
We haven't got to law school yet.
I know. But what was it about theater music, though? Because, I mean, you're talking to someone who also has another podcast that's going through an entire composer of musical theater. But I don't think that is something that the wide public, at least, is going like, man, theater music is where it's at. So what was it that drew you to theater music?
Well, it was music. It was music theater and Hollywood music. It's extraordinarily difficult to break into writing film scores. There are superstars in that area, and if you want a good film score, you go to Hans Zimmer or Danny Elfman or John Williams. There's not a lot of avenues for new guys. Every once in a blue moon, you get like a John Powell who comes in and breaks into that industry. But for the most part, it's inaccessible. So music theater actually is a lot easier to do. It's a lot easier to get started in, not easier to make it big in, but you do have opportunities to get started in music theater. So the reason I loved theater music, as you put it, is that you're allowed to write good sounding music in theater in a way that you're not allowed in academic music. If you try to write a chord or a tune that sounds good and is accessible in academic music, you will not make it in academic music. It will not be played, and you will be scorned. And that is a great loss. You know, academic art music has lost the audience, and they know it, but they can't seem to change course. So I said, okay, music theater, I can write tunes, I can write chord progressions, it can sound good, and it's okay. It's okay for me to express myself as a composer in a way that I find satisfying. So I went out and did that, and I spent from 2002 through 2008 working on mainly one show, which was originally called Paradise Lost and then later became called Sophia's Fall, and just doing iterations of it over and over and over again, putting it on stage, getting feedback, taking it off stage, writing it again. Rob Seidelman was a constant companion for most of those years, first as a producer, director, then as a co-writer, but I was the composer for that time.
So can you take me through that a little bit? Meaning, not to sound dismissive or anything like that, but was there funding that you were getting for this to put on these rehearsals and like workshop it and that sort of thing? Or was this really like a labor of love, like in your off time?
Well, both. I had to come up with the money to rent the theater and rent the theater rehearsal rooms and, you know, pay the musicians. I always have wanted to pay people fairly and pay them what they're worth. So I sort of balked at the idea of taking freebies, but on the other hand, like I only had so much money. So, you know, I did everything that I could within the rules set by the various unions in New York and produced these things as cheaply as I could. But no, I also had to get the money together. And for that reason, I will also take credit as a producer of theater in New York, never a big time, you know, Hollywood Broadway producer, but I do know how to produce a show.
Over those years, I guess, 6 years, I guess, that you were working on that, what did you ultimately learn about New York theater?
I learned that it is very clubby. It is very difficult to crack into the higher levels just by virtue of being good. We had good shows. The actors loved the shows. We had some good reviews, including from the New York Times, of our off-Broadway run in 2006. And I was not in New York full-time, and I was not good enough at networking in New York to make the kind of connections that I would have needed to make to take it to the next level in New York. And that was on me as the producer. It was my responsibility to make those connections and make it happen. And I didn't, because I was too busy trying to make the music as good as it could be. So end of the day, I own that, but it is bloody difficult to crack into being a music theater composer. I mean, it helps if you go to one of the graduate schools or you participate in one of the programs. But even then, like, it's just so clubby and so backroomy. It can be difficult for an outsider to make it in.
So then do you look back on that time? Because it was off-Broadway. Did it ever get to, like, off-Broadway or anything like that? Or did it stay, like, in some of the smaller theaters?
Well, in 2008, we finally got picked up for the New York Musical Theater Festival, which is the biggest and arguably the most prestigious music theater festival in the world. And they selected Sophia's Fall, which was the final iteration, for their 2008 program. And in that program, to answer your question, they put us in a theater on 37th and 10th. I think it was 37 Arts or something like that. And that was technically an off-Broadway house. So I can say that my show was played in an off-Broadway house, but it was an off-Broadway contract. So I have to be careful about how I say that if I want to be honest.
Do you look back at that entire experience as a failure, or is there stuff that you learn from that you enjoy or that you take and use in your everyday life now?
Oh, both. I mean, it was a failure financially and in terms of continuing production, but it was a very beautiful failure. It was an emotionally gripping failure. It was a failure that people loved and a failure that I'm immensely proud of. If you listen to my podcast, a lot of the incidental music that I use in the podcast is from Paradise Lost, and I like it. I mean, I think there's some beautiful music in there. I'm not using a lot of the sung tracks, and I'm saving some of them for later, but even the underscore or the incidental music, I like a lot. So I'm extremely proud of what we did together. Everyone, the cast, the creatives, Rob and me, I think we made something really beautiful and something that I still love listening to. And unfortunately, it was not the right show at the right time. It didn't find an audience, didn't find a producer, and we had to put it on the shelf.
So after 2008, what did you decide to do after this journey was over?
Well, honestly, I was, I think as many people get, emotionally exhausted and drained, and also financially exhausted. I mean, I'm still paying for that for that show. So I took a break. I was a computer programmer for several years. At some point, I got burned out with computer programming. I can pinpoint the exact date when I got burned out with computer programming. Actually, it was in 2009, and I woke up in a hotel room in Dubai after spending like 120 hour weeks doing this crazy kamikaze business analysis programming thing to try to automate a business process for a giant company that had offices in Dubai. So they flew us out there and we just like absorbed ourselves into the company and this crazy programming project. And I got super burned out. I was sick. I was just tired of it. And I thought, you know what? I'm done with this. I want to do something new. So I looked around at grad schools, took the LSAT, which is the entrance exam for law school in the United States, and loved it. Loved studying for the LSAT, which is not something that most people say. But I liked the logic games. I loved the analytical thinking, the reading, the writing. So I thought, this is probably a good fit. Went to law school, and it was a good fit. I did great in law school and had a wonderful, wonderful time.
Mm-hmm. How many years is that? Is that 4 years for a law degree, or is it more?
It's 3 in the U.S.
Oh, it's 3. Okay. Was that something you ever thought you would find yourself doing? Like, what was it about law that you decided, yes, this is my next career path?
Well, the intellectual rigor certainly appealed to me. I never thought I was going to law school. That came out of the blue, I think, for everybody around me as well as for me. Yeah, what drew me in was the intellectual rigor and the logical creativity that was required to get in. But then when I was there, what I found was that the process of trying to use reason to bring effect, to give effect to principles of right and wrong was incredibly stimulating. The idea that we would sit down and we would look at a set of facts, some problem that people have, and say, what is the right outcome here based on the law, based on the precedent, based on the letter of the statute, but what is the right outcome? What should happen here? Because you can always argue both sides of any legal issue. You can always do that. And they train you for that in law school, always argue both sides. So what that forces you to do at the end of the day is say, well, which of these actually would be right? And I'm arguing that maybe a free speech issue or a personal rights issue, like access to abortion in the United States is a huge personal rights mess right now. So in those kinds of situations, what you're really doing is you're taking principles of justice and you're trying to use reason to apply them to actual difficult facts, which is, frankly, that is justice. That's what justice is to me. And it was great. It was amazingly stimulating. And I love the writing, too.
I mean, I want to be very careful with how I'm going to phrase this next question, because it can come off as me being, I don't know, speaking ill, and I don't mean it to come off that way. But we started this conversation basically talking about like storytelling and Dungeons and Dragons and that sort of thing. Do you feel that being a lawyer, you're using some of those same skills, like you're crafting a story to argue in front of the judge?
Well, I'm not a lawyer anymore, so I'm not doing that anymore. When I was practicing law, absolutely, yeah, you're definitely telling a story. And any law school professor would tell you that's part of the discipline, is using the facts and the law to tell a story that's compelling to the decision maker. That is legit a part of the law. So yes, that was very much a part of the discipline that I enjoyed in the law. Now, the fact is that the actual practice of law doesn't involve very much of that. It's mostly sure. client management and keeping the lights on in a small business.
I mean, I've been seeing a bunch of reports come out lately about how the vast majority of cases actually never go to court. That's usually settled outside of court anyway. So what we perceive from Hollywood and other places is not necessarily what the justice system actually looks like in the United States. But you say you don't practice law anymore. Why don't you practice law anymore?
I had the opportunity to go and work for a company called Broadway HD, which was just getting started at the time I joined them in 2015. Broadway HD is a company that records and streams Broadway, off-Broadway, West End, and regional theater productions, which is a bloody brilliant idea. I mean, brilliant. You can't get to the theater, but you can still see a great show. So I had the opportunity to come in at a management and leadership level with them very early on. And I said, you know what? This is a once in a lifetime. It's an incredible fit for me. Yeah, I've got a law practice. It's going pretty well, but I need to run after this. And so I did. And that was one of the most incredible 2 years of my life.
Mm-hmm.
We did some just unreasonable things at Broadway HD. We live streamed the first ever Broadway show to be live streamed, which was mm-hmm. She Loves Me in 2016. The Guinness World Records recognized that a few months later as the first ever. And that was an exercise in total audacity to walk into a Broadway house with all of those unions and all of those people that control the rights and control the production and say, you know what? This is a great idea. We need to do this. Let's make a deal. Let's make this work. And we got ferocious resistance. We did it in about, I don't know, 2.5 weeks in order to get the live stream up at the date we'd announced. And it was magical. I mean, the cast was energized. They were 10 minutes ahead of the book or so during that live stream because they were so pumped up about it. Mm-hmm. The atmosphere in the house was electric because people knew this. Not only was this a first, but people all over the world were watching with them at the same time. We had, I think it was 87 countries. People from 87 different countries watched a Broadway show together with that audience in the house. And it was just an unbelievable experience. So that was an experience I'll never lose, I'll never forget, and something I am also incredibly proud of.
Yeah. Any idea why that hasn't become more popular? At least, like, there's obviously more and more content getting put onto Broadway HD all the time, but is why not first-run shows or stuff that's currently on Broadway being live-streamed? Why is that not happening more?
Now, the basic argument against it from the producer's perspective is that it's going to cannibalize ticket sales. That's the foundational fear, is that if people watch it on their TVs while it's also playing on Broadway, they won't then come and buy Broadway tickets. I don't think that's right. The Brits have got some good research that strongly suggests that is not correct. And they've been doing streaming and presentation of recorded theater for much longer than we have. So I think Broadway HD is going to eventually, if it's not Broadway HD, it'll be somebody very much like them. They will establish the norm that actually this is good. It allows people to recognize the property. It makes them comfortable with it if the show is good. And it will draw them in because they'll know what they're getting. Like if you're unsure about Mean Girls, for just to pick a random show that's on Broadway, if you're unsure about Mean Girls, maybe you like the cast album, but you're not sure if it's going to be fun, watch it online. And then if it is fun, you know that the live experience is more than that. It's the same thing between watching a concert live and watching a concert there, right? The experience is totally different and anything could happen at any time. But you know what you're getting. Like, you've seen the show and you know if you like it or not.
Yeah, I'm so aligned with you on this. I mean, I've seen a few different of the London shows live streamed here to our Canadian theaters. I actually saw the production of Angels in America that they put on over there with Nathan Lane and Andrew Garfield, which is so good. I love that production a whole lot. And I felt like I was part of the audience because you can still hear like the gasps and like the audience movements. I don't know. You just feel like you're part of this bigger thing.
Right.
And I just, I don't know. I would, and I'm never going to fly over to London and watch it. Like they're not, I'm giving them money because I'm never going to be able to do that. I'd even be willing to pay a premium just so I could watch certain Broadway shows just live from my couch. And then when I do go to New York every like 5 or 6 years, I'd be like, oh, this is the one I need to go and see. That's me.
The hope.
So The Bright Path, this
yeah.
is the book that you wrote
mm-hmm.
and the podcast that you're producing on the book. When did that story start to enter your mind?
There are a couple of different sources for that. One of them is a story I've been trying to tell in Dungeons & Dragons games for probably a decade. And bizarrely, the games keep stopping midway, not because people aren't having fun, but because like the players have other things to do. So mm-hmm. twice that happened. And it was in a prefab module that I kept modifying heavily. And the more I did this, like the second time through I was doing it, I said to myself, you know what, actually I really like the modifications I'm making to this thing better than the base module, and I want to develop those in a game. But then my second game petered out and I said, oh god, you know, all right, I'm just going to have to write this down because I can't get a group of players to stick around long enough to play through this story that I want to tell. So at that point, I started drafting foundation material for The Bright Path. But then I think that's the overall structure of the thing. But what I hope people find is the emotionally engaging and character-driven parts of the story really come from me, from my personal life, and from some emotional difficulties that I've had to overcome and have overcome, but which have been difficult. So I've really tried to reach down and take some of that and turn it into something that's not just, you know, self-therapy, but is something fun and interesting and compelling. I think every author has to do that. I think you've got to reach down and find something in yourself that's bugging you, that's driving you crazy, that you need to get out, but you don't have any other way to get it out. And I think you take that and you split it into a million little pieces and you put them together again into something totally new. And it's a bunch of characters, or it's situations, or it's a setting, it's a love affair, it's a battle on a rooftop, whatever it is. You've got to be drawing that from a place of, frankly, either pain or longing inside you, I think. Now, I've only written the one book, so I don't have a career worth of experience to relate here, but I think ultimately, the writers who are good are pulling out their own pain and they're turning it into something new. They're turning it into something beautiful. Or not. I mean, you know, Catcher in the Rye is a pretty dark story, but mm-hmm. I'm sure he got that from someplace.
Oh, sure. Well, what was the stuff that was bugging you then that you were trying to work through?
Well, I think the big emotional driver for me, and anybody who starts to read the story will immediately see this, was the loss of a relationship. And the confusion and the pain and the just bewilderment of that feeling that something that had been so close and so important was now gone. And I don't want to telegraph to people that that's what the book is about, because it's not. But a lot of where I think the emotional impact is coming from, not just in the two sort of young male and female lead, but in some of the other characters as well, is that feeling of bewilderment and that feeling of loss from having lost somebody that I loved.
Hmm. Do you worry about legacy at all?
How so? What do you mean by that?
Meaning that for your creative drives, do you feel it's because you want to leave something behind of yourself, or is that a driver at all?
No, not at all. I don't necessarily think that this will be something that gets left behind. I mean, the chances of it becoming widely successful are very, very small. What has driven me is the need to get it out. Not to leave it behind, to get it out and to put it on page. You know, I think people, you should really only try to be a writer if it's the only way to live with yourself. And mm-hmm. It's the same thing I say about entrepreneurs. You should really only try to be an entrepreneur if it's the only way you can live with yourself. If there's such a drive and a burning desire inside you that if you went to a day job, you'd just jump out of something quickly. So I think that's the urge for me.
Just because I don't want to get too far away from it, can you describe just the setup of your book for people?
Yeah, so sure, absolutely. The Bright Path is, it's actually a comedy. I've made it sound like it's kind of dark, but it's, I think of it as a comedy. It's two young people in a very small village in an Earth-like fantasy world whose quiet lives are interrupted when a very cranky, obstreperous professor named Cyrus Stoat rides into town and is looking for a lost book. They end up tangled up with this tribe of goblins, and then they go south to one of the big cities and get tangled up in intrigue there. A bunch of religious fanatics invade the country. But what's going on ultimately in the plot line is, I think, a meditation through very concrete real world, not real world, through very concrete situations with the characters and through their relationships, a meditation on how thought and language and perception are actually magic. And this is not a fantasy book in which there are wizards hurling fireballs around. There's practically none of that. But there is a lot of time spent thinking about how we think and how we talk and what that means internally. And then I hope the magic that happens at the end of the book grows out of that. That sense of mystery and wonder around language and thought and perception, and that the way you speak and the way you think actually can create your perception of the world. That's where it tries to get to by the end. But there's, you know, jokes are cracked, pies are thrown, and you know, I hope there's plenty of levity. It's mainly a lighthearted rom. Mm-hmm.
Now, I mentioned before that you're doing a podcast version of this book. Where did that idea come from?
You know, that was it came from you, Kyle. You had put a little note on LinkedIn, a little article on LinkedIn that I read about how there's this renaissance of podcasts and lots of people are listening. And I thought, you know, why not? That's a good organic marketing strategy for the book. Let me just read this sucker. I'll give it away if you want to listen to me read it. And I do all kinds of strange voices and you know, it's fun, but it's not the book. It's different than the book. Mm-hmm. And so my hope is, and you know, I hope this is starting to be borne out, that people who enjoy the podcast will also enjoy the book or will want somebody else that they know to enjoy the book. So that's what motivated me to do it. I mean, I'm not going to lie. It's a marketing exercise, but I also don't see any moral failure in wanting to give something away to people to promote it and to to make them interested in it. So me and Ayn Rand together are greatly enthralled by the idea of enlightened self-interest. It is in my enlightened self-interest to give this away to people so that ultimately it will make money.
I can honestly say I was not anticipating an Ayn Rand reference during our conversation here today. But there we go. So I guess, like, looking ahead, I feel like it's so hard for you to nail down what you're going to be doing in like 6 months, let alone like 5 years from now. But are there any things that you are working towards or hope to accomplish in the next few years?
You know, one of the biggest challenges for me, Kyle, has been how inconsistent, maybe spastic is the word, has my career has been. I mean, I've been a composer and a computer programmer and a lawyer and a writer and all kinds of things in between. So that can be good and it can be energizing, but it can also be unhealthy if you just can't fall into some kind of a rhythm and really devote some time to something. So I would love to keep writing. I like the day job I have now. I'm in technology management for a company in New York, and that's fine. It's a good day job. I appreciate the company. But I would love to keep writing. I know that I have to put in a lot of work on marketing and publicity and trying to get people to read the silly thing. And I feel like I need to do that before I can start the next one, because if nobody's going to read it, you know, I'm not sure there's a lot of point. Maybe there is, but you know, if I can get a core audience that's interested in hearing the second part of this story, then I will absolutely write it. And I would love to write it, and maybe I'll write it anyway, but if nobody's reading it, it's going to take another 10 years.
Sure. No, I get that.
But I think, you know, for an artist, there is also a value in consistency. There's a value in having some stability in your life. And my life has been very unstable for the last decade. I mean, I was married, I got divorced, I've got a kid who I love to death. She's like the best kid in the world. And I've just been all over the place. So I really need, as a human being and as a writer, to settle down and to just put my head down and focus and make my life better.
How does your daughter inspire you?
She's one of the smartest, funniest, most full of character people I know. She's really developed a sense of humor and a sense of levity that I feel like I've lacked for years. She's just full of ideas and full of questions. She wants to do a podcast. Actually, we've started recording a podcast together she wants to call The Boring Life of Adults, where she like asks me about boring adult things and I have to explain them. So the very first episode, I said, Ivy, what do you want it to be about? And she said, Dad, taxes. And I said, there must be something more interesting than taxes that we could talk about for 30 minutes. And she said, no, I want to talk about taxes. So we spent 30 minutes like talking about the theory of taxation with a 9-year-old. That's the kind of kid she is.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's great. Have those episodes been released yet?
No, I want to get 3 of those together and then, maybe I'll put them out as their own or maybe I'll just give them out as bonus episodes in The Bright Path. We'll see.
Yeah. this podcast is part of the Alberta Podcast Network and there's this one called That's a Thing where a mother and her 13 or 14-year-old daughter, I think, do the inverse of that where it's the parent trying to figure out stuff that her daughter is into and like memes and stuff that's going on YouTube and trying to understand what's going on there. But I like this, the reverse of that, which you're doing, where it's just like, yeah, kids are like, so what's the deal with taxes? And it's like, boy, I don't know. Let me try to explain it to you.
Yeah, see if you can explain that to a 9-year-old. If so, you're probably doing something right.
I feel like for me, I would get like 5 minutes in and be like, man, taxes are stupid, aren't they?
Well, I was trying not to go there. I mean, I'm a pretty individualistic libertarian type myself. So I put on my lawyer hat. And I was like, okay, here's the theory for taxes. Here's why people think taxes are good. And this is what you, this is what you get with taxes. You get government services and safety nets. And, I think I did a pretty good job of being balanced.
That's good. That's great. So if someone was to come to you then, and I guess I'll pick from a few different ones. They're maybe a musical composer or they're a writer or a fresh computer programmer. And they're like, I just don't know. Like, I need advice on what to do and what I should be focusing on. Like, what type of advice would you give those people?
I think the advice is you've got to really get in touch with what you love. And you've got to be fucking fearless about going after it, knowing that you will probably fail. Like I put that show on stage over and over and over again, got myself way into debt to get the money together, knowing that it would fail, but knowing that I had to do it anyway, that I had to see it on stage. I had to share it with people. I had to hear that audience clap and hear them laugh at the jokes. You've got to be just fearless about running after the thing that makes you happy and that drives you, not even makes you happy, because sometimes it'll make you miserable, but you got to know that that's what you're after, whether it's writing a book or putting a play on stage or getting into the gaming industry as a computer programmer or whatever it is. So many people, I think, sort of know, but then chicken out in a major way and be like, oh, I need to pay the bills. I got to pay my rent. I'm just going to get a job. And 50 years later, they're selling shoes. You can't do that. You just cannot do that. If you want to be totally fulfilled in yourself, you've just got to grab life by the balls. And this sounds totally generic, but look, the honest truth is if you don't love what you're doing and you're not prepared to do it, even if it's going to fail, then you're not doing this right.
Something I've also started to do here in the show is ask what books people have read and draw an inspiration from. And I don't know if you have a few examples of books that you, that are important in your life.
Absolutely. Well, we already talked about Tolkien, so I won't retread that ground. Terry Pratchett is freaking brilliant, as I was. Unfortunately, he's dead now.
Yeah.
As somebody who brought together comedy, drama, emotion, and critical commentary of society. I mean, that guy, I could read every single one of his books 3 times, and there's a lot of his books.
Yeah.
David Eddings has another author who's passed away, brilliant characters. I mean, knows how to write a loving, endearing character in a way that makes me, at least, want to read his books over and over again, and I have. David Brin, for sure. David Brin, I mean, the great example there would be the Uplift series. for just massive multi-perspective narrative. He's got like 10 characters going at once, mixed voice, mixed tense, unreliable narrators, and somehow manages to just pull the thing together into this incredible climax. So I love David Brin for that. You know what? I'm going to come back to Ayn Rand again and say Atlas Shrugged meant something to me. I don't necessarily agree with the outcomes that she espouses. I don't necessarily agree with her political philosophy, although some of it, but her ability to use emotional impact to argue a political theory point is just brilliant. So I give Ayn Rand respect for that. L. Ron Hubbard for incredible long-form pacing in Battlefield Earth. If you haven't read the book, just put the movie out of your mind and read Battlefield Earth, because he does not let you put it down. He will not let you put that book down. It is so gripping all the way through. And then I would say Mike Carey's Lucifer series. It's a graphic novel series that picks up the Lucifer character from The Sandman, which everybody knows, Neil Gaiman, and tells like a 12-book graphic novel epic on Lucifer. What I love about that is his relentless, his illustration of the narrative power of self-will combined with dark fantasy, and frankly, a relentlessly romantic storytelling, romantic with a capital R, in the sense of unapologetic individualism first emerging in the 19th century. So that, I'd say Mike Carey Lucifer is well worth a read and very easy to read. And that one has meant a lot for me. I think I said online at one point in one of my podcast posts, that's a series I pull off the shelf when I have lost hope. When I've lost the ability to believe in myself, I pull off Lucifer and read it again, and that brings me back.
Well, I'll put some links to what you just recommended in the description of this podcast episode. And not to diverge too far off point as we're wrapping up here, but just because you just mentioned L. Ron Hubbard, of course, the father of Scientology, and that's all I really know him for. Is he actually a good writer? Because I've kind of stayed away from him just because of what's happened since his passing away.
Yeah. You know, the religion stuff is very weird. And I think you'll also realize as you read the book, I have a pretty critical view of religion myself.
Yeah.
L. Ron Hubbard wrote Battlefield Earth. Battlefield Earth is one of, in my opinion, one of the great science fiction novels. It came in for some criticism, I think mainly for people who didn't like Scientology. But there's no Scientology in Battlefield Earth. It's a rollicking adventure that goes a mile a minute all the way through, and it has one of the most offbeat but strangely satisfying endings of any science fiction novel I've ever read. So well worth sticking through it with it through the end.
All right. Well, that's good. Well, thank you so much for joining me here today, Ben. This has been a really great chat. If people wanted to stay in contact with you somehow online, how could they do that?
Well, I would say go on over to brightpathbook.com. That's the website for the book and the podcast, and there are links to subscribe to the podcast if for some reason you haven't got enough of my voice, or if you have had enough of my voice, there are links to the book, and the book will arrive in your Kindle instantly or in your mailbox in 7 to 10 days.
All right. That's great. Well, thank you again, Ben.
Thank you so much, Kyle. It has been a real pleasure.
Well, there you go. Thanks again to Ben for taking the time out of his busy life to spend an hour with me. I feel better for it. As Ben mentioned at the end, you can find more information about his book and podcast at brightpathbook.com. I also found a link to some video game footage of Mantra where you can hear some of Ben's compositions as a high schooler. I've included those in the description to this episode. There are a bunch of links to books you can find there as well. Thanks to the Alberta Podcast Network, to ATB, and to Back to School Again this week. If you have suggestions for people you'd like me to talk to, even if that's you, please send them to info@medialabyyc.com. And most importantly, thanks for listening. Let other people know if you enjoy it. We'll be back again next week. Have a great day.